Welcome to Culture, Talent, and Growth. Join Anish Shah and the Ruckus team as they invite dynamic leaders to share what they've learned about creating lasting culture, attracting great talent, and achieving sustainable growth. Let's get started.
Hi, and thank you for joining us. This is Scaling Startups Across Europe and the US with Bumble, Lyft, Groupon, Kabam, and Framer. Anish, some introductions.
So my background was being in-house and consulting and growth and marketing for different startups, and then started an executive recruiting firm about 4 or 5 years ago. Now we're a team of, I believe, 14. And most of what we do is hiring senior leadership across marketing, growth, product analytics, and design, generally for fast growing startups. We've unfortunately not done a ton of searches. And by not doing a ton, I mean zero searches in Europe. But hopefully I can learn more about that landscape from this panel.
So my name is Maud. I have a background in growth in both the US and in Europe. Some of the notable roles that had an international span. I was doing international marketing for Guild Group, led growth for Secret. That was an international social media app. And most recently was leading EMEA for Bumble. And nowadays I am working with the awesome photo editing app that's called Photoroom, one of the top photo editing app that's in about 40 countries, but launched businesses in Europe, US businesses in Europe and the other way around. So happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Hey guys, my name is Matt. I've done a couple sort of far reaching international roles. I obviously grew up in the States and I was the head of partner management for Groupon in China. I was also the head of customer care in Australia and New Zealand. For Lyft, I was really doing domestic work, but similar sort of launching heavy operational, then compliance, and then renter experience work. And then I scaled up Wind Mobility from, you know, like one city to almost like 10 countries around EMEA. It's a pleasure to be here.
Hey, I'm Boris. Also been around quite a while setting up U.S. companies in Europe or European companies in the U.S. pretty much all my life. Started with my own company when I was just 18, where we opened up in Atlanta and in England. Then worked for IBM, set up European offices for one of their subsidiaries, and just continued doing that all my life until I started my own company, Riddle.com, and finally stopped collecting frequent flyer miles, even before the shutdown.
That's awesome. And part of the impetus for this event was actually meeting Boris and him giving me so many anecdotes and about how different it is doing business in Europe, how different it is recruiting in Europe, how different it is culturally on a day-to-day basis. So, you know, part of this event was just really wanted to explore that with even more people who kind of basically built businesses that were popular, well-known across both the US and Europe.
Hi, everyone. My name is Asha. So I'm originally from Malaysia, but I blame my accent on the 10 years I spent in the US, where I was mostly in San Francisco working at a number of different startups, social networks, gaming. And then I made the move across the pond to Amsterdam, where I started working at Framer when it was first a seed company. So Framer is a design and prototyping tool for teams. Today we're Series B, so seeing the company kind of scale a lot, you know, mostly in the European market, a lot of good learnings there. And yeah, I'm excited to kind of be here today.
And also, we're going to give a shout out to Asha. She just got promoted to VP of Marketing. Clearly knows.
Zoom clap.
We'll dig into the first question. How should a startup who is now at a place that people actually like their products, people know what they do, there's good product market fit. Let's say you're US-based and you want to go to another market. How do you think about that? What's the next step from there?
Yeah, so I think the framework that I really like was thinking about three buckets of country. You know, one where you're kind of already seeing traction and so you have some sort of validation of the value proposition. And so probably want to double down on these. So that's kind of bucket number one. Bucket number two would be, you know, countries where you're seeing some kind of traffic and organic traffic, but maybe not as strong of a conversion. So you may want to investigate, you know, what's the reason behind them. And then third is countries where you have neither of this, but from a value proposition standpoint and maybe kind of market dynamic standpoint, it makes sense for you to go and investigate and look and test the value prop in the market. And so that's the third bucket. And then from there, you know, the prioritization framework that I really liked, I think that's former head of growth at Dropbox that offered it, was the ICE framework. So looking at all these countries and looking at ICE, I for impact, C is for confidence, and then E, effort. So it's all of the engineering effort.
Okay, nice. And when you're evaluating like the impact, how do you think about impact and confidence? Is it just sort of like total addressable market? Is it size? Is it kind of like how much people generally spend on a product that's similar to yours? Are there other products in the market so people are comfortable with it? How do you sort of think about approaching that? Because I can imagine there's a lot of factors to kind of weigh right there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't know if anyone wants to weigh in, but before you get to some level of confidence, I think you will have understood which one of like these three buckets of countries as the opportunity fall into. And then, you know, you look at different factors like market size, you know, it could be anything from kind of mobile penetration. Then you look at the competitive landscape. You look at the organic traction of the company. So yeah, quite a few different buckets of areas.
Yeah. And I like the fact that you brought up looking at your organic traffic, even a product that is functional in that particular country, it probably gives you a good window. Anyone else have any kind of insight there?
I think it depends a lot if you do B2B or B2C. This, mm-hmm. I think B2B is a lot easier. You can do things like look at your traffic as something growing without you doing anything. B2B may be harder. A good example I could bring, I worked at NXN, a German company. We were doing production management for gaming companies. Pretty much the market leader in the Western world, all the big companies, Ubisoft, EA, they were all using us. And when I joined, the team had a Japanese localized version and been trying to sell into Japan for 2 years, $0 revenue, just couldn't sell anything. So it's one of my jobs to open a new market. So we looked at the market. The first thing they didn't do before, they didn't have a local person, which I thought was horrible. When you go to a new market, hire someone who knows the market. Don't try to do it yourself, especially if it's in Asia. We don't understand. We will never fully understand it, as hard as we try. So the first thing was to hire someone, which is really hard. So that's where succeeded eventually. And then we looked at the market in B2B and we figured this was gaming. So if you want to succeed in gaming, you have to sell to the number one game company in that market. And that's always kind of been my mantra when I go into the market. Try to get the number one recognized player to like you, to buy your stuff, and then everything else will follow. So we went after Nintendo, which is the biggest game company. And I spent 1 year flying to Kyoto once or twice a month. My wife would probably know better how often I flew there. Way too much. But in the end, I ended up drinking tea with Shigeru Miyamoto, the guy who invented Mario, and he bought our software. And after that, we had that market. Everyone followed suit and bought. So that strategy paid off. I don't know if it pays off everywhere, but we kept on doing that in other new markets. Like when we moved into animated movies, we targeted Pixar and we sold to Pixar. After you sell to Pixar in animated movies, every animation studio will buy your tool.
Wow.
So that worked. And it, you know, similar, we did the same at Riddle. We wanted to get into sports and we sold to Man City. And when you sell to Man City, then afterwards, you know, Arsenal bought and Manchester United bought and it crossed the pond and then, you know, the Chicago Bulls bought and the Bears and the NFL and it trickles down because they all talk to each other and they move inside that industry bubble. So that worked for B2B for me.
Okay, that's super interesting. And I've actually not heard that sales strategy before of just like go for the royalty, mm-hmm. put all your eggs in that basket and then watch it sort of trickle down afterward. I've actually heard a lot of the opposite, like, you know, picking all the smaller companies because they're faster to get and then kind of work your way up. So I kind of like the opposite.
If you're Silicon Valley, VC funded, you'll never have the freedom to do this because it takes too long.
Yeah,
VCs don't have that patience.
What's the sales cycle if you're like going after, you know, like royalty, one royalty kind of sitting in the throne in the industry?
So it took us a year to close Nintendo. And the sale wasn't even massive. I mean, they bought like 10 seats of our software initially. But it was just the message that was sending that was important. But we had German VCs and had a completely different mindset, you know, than a Silicon Valley VC. They would have never let us do that ever.
Fascinating. And maybe that's a cultural difference right there as well. Like, do you think there's a longer leash from European venture companies of like, you don't need to be a unicorn in like a year?
There used to be. I don't think it's, that was probably 20 years ago. So, or 18 years ago in that range, but that has changed. That has changed. I've worked with other European VCs in the nearer past, and they've become very American. Their mantra now is fail fast.
I will chime in from the perspective of a business that is asset heavy. So you can't really lean startup test these, but what you can is think about what you actually have leverage over before you move any asset. So really break down the components of the business and start to think about what is the, if you can test customer acquisition and see what the cost of acquiring a customer is. Start to cost out what things like customer service would cost, what sort of like regulatory burden you might be facing. And if you are trying to do something that's lean startup and you have assets and you're trying to enter a new market, I would take all that and color it as best you can with like baseline data and then get locals to help fill in the blanks. There is no replacement for native local knowledge. I don't know if you guys have found the same thing, but in operational businesses, it's unequivocally, it's unmatched.
I think that echoes what Boris said, that Americans can't just walk in and say like, oh yeah, this is basically America with like an accent that's not American.
Yeah, I can piggyback off of that a little bit because that's also been sort of my experience where we've actually used performance marketing to kind of test, you know, new markets as well. And that's really interesting because, you know, with a decent budget in copy and assets, you can kind of test really quickly, get to a point where you like getting good cost for registration per user. But I think what's important there is that then you need to look at like, are you retaining these users? How are they using your product? And so just like keeping track of all those things. But like we've, you know, over a 6-month period been able to kind of like nail down specific markets. So I would say that's been most effective as far as like, and I think something that a lean startup could pick up on as well. And then the other interesting one, which is more surprising, which I think takes more time upfront, like time and investment, is community building. So that's something where we would find champions where they would find us, you know, in markets like South Korea or Brazil. And we'd invest time in sort of like onboarding them with Framer and like kind of treat them almost like you would with, you know, a customer success team and an enterprise client. So we did that very early on at Framer and it really paid off because those markets, you know, we invested in them. They kind of put that effort out twofold where they were taking time out of their own lives to have these like Framer classes and then they were like teaching it and then they would even, we even use them to go to companies sometimes and they would be like evangelists at these companies. So a lot of our initial like enterprise deals at these, you know, in these foreign markets were from native people who were just huge evangelists for Framer. And it was kind of really interesting. It was a bit more time consuming, but it like definitely paid off as well. It was sort of that native element.
Nice. Okay. I love the idea about finding like champions for your product. And when you found that, was just people who from your data were like obsessed with using it, or did they like tweet a lot, or were they just like in community boards? Like, how do you find these like hyper champions?
Yeah. I mean, so we as a company, like most, we empower like all our employees to be super involved, like, you know, from the CEO down, everyone's kind of like involved in the community, especially in the early days. And so we were having a lot of communication with them. And then you would see people kind of like get singled out or just kind of stand out from the crowd. But there was sort of in the early days, this like fanaticism around Framer. And so people reached out to us. They're like, do you have tools? Do you have like guides? Do you, you know, I want to have like a meetup and I want to teach Framer to more people. So we just really were kind of, you know, catching up to them. So in a way we were lucky with something like that, but I think it's also something that you can, you know, create for yourself at your company.
Okay. That's awesome. I like that idea a lot. Cool. Let's jump to the next. Yeah, this is actually a really good question. Any anecdotes of specific things that have worked in the US? And then when you try to take it elsewhere, it was just, because I think Boris and Matt really touched upon the fact that you can't just, you know, copy paste. So what exactly did you attempt to copy paste and did it not work?
Well, I can tell you that, and Boris, you probably know this better than I do, is that Germans do not respond well to push notification.
Really?
Yeah. No, Europe in general is much more guarded about things like, you know, email campaigns and push notifications. The data privacy is taken really seriously here, as it should be. But the flexibility that you get from it, like an American audience, it doesn't translate to Europe. And in fact, it can wind up doing more harm than good. If you come in with this sort of traditional American approach and start hitting with like push notifications, really aggressive email marketing, you'll lose interest and you'll probably get complaint.
Love that example.
I can chime in more from a campaigns and cultural standpoint. I had a really interesting challenge at Bumble. So you know the vertical of dating, right? And the what dating means and where the cultures are at. You know, the US versus Germany versus France versus the UK, drastically different. So I take an example. I had to launch Bumble in France. And so if you were to go into France saying, you know, men make the first move, like Bumble didn't work actually in France with that main kind of leading message, because the approach of dating in France is it's pretty much equal. And there's, you know, feminism that was born in France is kind of contradictory, but women don't like to be told kind of what to do. And so really had to take a really different approach there. And so we led by kind of different couple of angles. But what it brings me to say is that I think, again, speaking from a consumer angle, and I think B2B is completely different, but where you're seeing brands succeed today, it's a lot on community and content. And both of these are highly, highly local. And I think, you know, the nuances of each culture, the nuances of who drives culture and who drives influence in each one of these markets is, it's very different. So you have to really understand these specific notions, and that you do by, again, and I think we'll probably come to the same conclusion here, by hiring the absolute best talent on the ground to really help you understand these nuances.
Okay, that's great. And I like that you pinpoint community and content as being kind of like the drivers for a lot of brand. And that's fascinating about the whole like women have to make the first message worked better in the US than in
Yeah. And then same in Germany. In Germany, they were like, hey, I don't want to talk, like, we're equal. So what are you talking about? You know? And so it was more about, hey, this is the coolest app to get into and to meet great people. So we had to change the positioning a little bit in each one of the European markets. We had to.
That's super interesting. Yeah. Any other things that have sort of worked in the US and then didn't like translate so well to other markets?
I think all the monster campaigns that ran on TV in the US, they tried to run them all in Europe and force them on the European GMs. And I think there was one single market where they worked. Because first, the name doesn't work. Monster, it has a bad connotation in a lot of markets. And again, it's very similar to what Mott said. The hiring and job market is so different, for example, in France than in the US. You know, you essentially enter a marriage when you join a big French company. You don't plan to be there for 2 years and leave. So everything's taken more serious. And the monster ads were all about, oh, just go run out, grab one great job, then move to the next. And that completely failed. But they completely also refused to localize. And I think especially the French general manager went through a heart attack every time a new TV ad aired.
That's awesome. Did you eventually come around to create ads that were more enticing for that audience? And if so, like what did they feature that made it a little bit more enticing for the French audience?
The company would never allow for that as long as I was there, unfortunately.
Okay.
We did better in other companies where we just let the local teams hire a local agency to do ads.
Makes sense.
Something you learned post-launch from pre-launch market research. We're already in the market, you know, and what I say by launching is really putting some more resources on the ground. So we're doing some paid marketing in France. And then we started to do more, you know, content and community, as I mentioned. And something we launched, pre-launch is actually a strategy of thinking about content, community, and influence. Really worked. And it was really into tapping in, you know, having that cultural message that resonated and then having the right influencer to kind of disperse that message. And so that worked really well.
I think that makes sense. I mean, you were kind of already there and then you learned. And I guess what was the mechanism for you to learn that yeah, the sort of woman goes first kind of function of Bumble? Like, was it customer feedback or just things not converting as well? Or
yeah, so I think Bumble has always been super strong, and I was always impressed with how customer insights really led a lot of what we were doing. So there wasn't a campaign we'd put out in a while that hadn't been run through customer insights and kind of heavy, including testing, right? So when we started to do, you know, campaigns, and we did out of home campaigns, we run a couple of versions through customer insights. So having more of the analytical feedback on what we're doing, but prior to having a kind of analytical in customer insights feedback, it was really hiring the right people. And so I found two great freelancers. I think one of the questions it will get to is hiring full-time versus freelancers. I'm very adamant about de-risking and working with folks who've done it before, and whether on a full-time or kind of consulting basis. And so I was really lucky to really find folks who understood these nuances of dating and really translated it really well.
That's awesome. Yeah, that must be a hard, like, hard find to find, like, a European dating tech consultant. So what are the most valuable KPIs to look at, and which ones are misleading or distracting? I think you guys have touched upon a little bit of the KPIs that you look at, but if there's anything that you've used, and I don't know, Maud kind of went through her the ICE framework and so forth, but I don't know if there's any additional stuff.
It's so tempting, because I think as data and access to data has become more prevalent throughout all organizations, it's become a little bit harder to not care about certain numbers. So, you know, if someone grabs a hold of a vanity metric and they start really pushing it, you might find that it gets traction in the whole organization. And it just winds up vacuuming off resources to deal with a non-existent problem, even though there's data to support that, you know, a number is going down. So I don't think that there's like a specific individual thing that I can say is or isn't valuable as a KPI. What I can say is that anything that you're measuring, and you can only measure a certain amount of things effectively in a given dashboard, you should be able to draw a straight line to the OKR or whatever tracking system that you use for the company goals. And if you can't tie it to something that gets you further along in the company goal, then it's probably just a vanity metric, right? For instance, like, you know, in the scooter business, like an unlock fail would be the example of, you could draw a straight line to people not being able to unlock it and therefore not ever trying again, which would increase your churn rate, which is bad, right? So that's an easily traceable metric towards something that matters to the company. And then, you know, I'm trying to think of a good vanity metric, but I tried to get them all out of my head. So I'll just let everybody else talk. I try not to consume vanity metrics if it's at all possible.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, I think also what I've seen is like sort of like the earliest state or like, you know, early stage of like a startup, like it can be enticing to look at the vanity metrics or only look at the, like, you know, numbers that are moving up and to the right and sort of galvanize the company around that. But I think, yeah, like to Matt's point, it's like super important to draw a line between that and what the company goals are. And then also, like, you know, what is this, like, make sure that you're not just like reading, you know, growth blogs and other, like doing what other companies do and making sure that it's actually aligned with like where you need to go. Like if are you focused in revenue growth or are you focused in acquisition? If you are focused in acquisition, are you also then looking at churn, right? Because you need to know if you have a leaky bucket, like looking more at like long-term health. And I think that's sort of the thing that has been really interesting for us, where it's actually not just the job of the data team at the company to know these things. It's sort of like, if we can educate more people at the company, whether it's the marketing team or the product team, about the right metrics to care about per team and then connect that all to the company goals, like that's sort of where we've seen sort of like the most success, right? Like we just have to give people the right context, the right education and how to understand data, have these dashboards, you know, and like, and every team has a dashboard where you only maybe have like three or four things that you look at maybe every week. That's really where you start to see like the connection between the, you know, the metrics that you're looking at and the work that you're doing. And then I think when you can show people that impact, like that's really like, that's been a huge difference for us. Like, and I would say that it took probably a year to make everyone care of how metrics, right? It's not inherently a thing that people care about, but once you make that connection, like you do start to kind of reap the benefits, like, you know, throughout the company.
I love that. I love what you also mentioned with the trading off of long-term versus short-term metrics. It helps you have a different viewpoint. Like even running a services-based firm like us, I think most people would assume what we really care about is just getting new clients in the door. Just like, how do we close more deals? How do we close more deals? How do we close more deals? But like, I don't really care. I want new business, but at the same time, it's not my focus. My focus is more so, how do we do really well for the current clients? And they'll bring in the next clients. You know, if they like the service, everyone knows each other. It's a small world, but it doesn't always, you know, turn out that way in the short term. You might have to wait a year, but you know, once you left a trail of happy, you know, satisfied customers, the rest just takes care of itself. I think a lot of people who start agencies are just obsessed with lead generation and obsessed with net new conversations and generally just do a shitty job for their current clients because they're so focused on like being an influencer or getting out there, you know, posting poetry or whatever. And not taking the time to actually do a good job for the current companies and then, you know, reap the benefits of that over the long term. So I like that it's not always intuitive on a short-term basis, but it makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the most important thing for me to look at, it's the same as you, Anish, was always retention. If you don't have retention, you don't have a company. At Kabam, which is a game company where it's been quite a few years, that was hammered into everyone, no matter where you worked in the company. If what you did didn't help retention, it was useless. Especially mobile games or games, you know, people don't come back to play, you don't make money. But I think even your approach, you have the same approach for services, essentially. Because you're trying to retain clients by keeping them happy. And if you do that well, then your company is going to grow.
Yeah, it just may not grow as quickly as if I put all my eggs into the sales basket. But what I've learned is a year or two later, it makes sales a whole lot easier. When I don't have to like sell someone and like deal with a poor reputation for people running around saying they didn't have a good experience. So no, totally. And the long game really, really helps with this. Cool. Let's jump to the next one, Greg. In summarization, what are the best UA channels in European countries? Does it differ from the US? Like basically from our experience, in at least the US companies, you know, everyone's initial cool kit is paid search and paid social. And that goes across industries, that goes across even B2C and B2B very frequently. So I don't know if things are different in Europe or if there's some unique channels that you tap in Europe more.
Only nuance on the consumer side is for influencers and social media. I think you're seeing the penetration of, you know, Snap is really strong in France, for example. It's not as strong in Germany, I think, for some reason. Penetration of TikTok and kind of so more of the most recent social platforms. So you might want to check that. And we know how social media, from a paid perspective, influencer perspective, is probably more than 50% of marketing budget for a lot of consumer companies. So so that's the only nuance.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so influencer spikes higher maybe in Europe than US.
Oh, in some no. In some it depends on the platforms, right? So if So you need to understand the maturity of like some of the platforms in different countries.
Yeah, I'm bringing again like the sort of asset world into it, which I know is different than what most people are talking about. But like we had a lot of luck with in person or like using the asset as marketing, and also like subway stations. So we got a lot of mileage out of a branded T-shirt and someone handing out flyers. And I think this is probably different, but the takeaway for me is, no matter what business you're running, start to think about other ways that are worth testing with like a few hundred bucks that you can see maybe that there's actually a very efficient channel that other people in the industry haven't touched. And I don't know if you guys had any experience with that as well, but we found really high user conversion in very strange places.
Anecdotally, wild posting, which is not like half legal in France, works in Paris.
What's wild posting?
Wild posting is out of home, but just in.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so that works really well. I know that's not the case in all cities, but to your point, it's like going deeper to kind of the geo for offline stuff. And there might be some really cool untapped opportunities.
I like that. I've never heard that term wild posting. It makes a lot more sense when you explain it. Just all those like posters that are glued around a city, essentially.
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome.
And I remember actually the transition when Lyft started doing billboards, they decided to do like an experiential billboard that was actually text that was so dense that you could only read it if you were staring at it. And the takeaway was like, if you were trying to drive your car, there's no way that you could read this. Isn't it great to be in the passenger seat? And it was such a clever way of like flipping that idea of like clean takeaways in a billboard to just flipping it on its head.
That's fascinating. Although I'm a little worried for the driver who's trying to squint their eyes.
Sure.
I mean, trying to make that happen. So maybe if it's on like the 101 or 280, people are locked into traffic anyways. So yeah, I'm wondering whether like something like out of home actually maybe scales for some reason, like people trust billboards more and trust kind of direct mail a little bit more in other countries than, you know, the general US toolkit of paid search and paid social. Maybe because there's not as much penetration of so many companies advertising in those mediums. I'd be curious about that.
I can speak for like direct mail because I was kind of fascinated by the fact that, you know, in the US and you had a couple of agencies that had just started to work with direct mail and scaling some direct to consumer companies that way. Haven't that seen that in Europe nearly as much. So definitely some nuances.
Okay, cool. There's a question. Are macro influencers more effective than micro influencers in Europe? And probably for the audience, even defining what a macro influencer versus a micro influencer here is, if anyone wants to touch upon that. I think there's like a metric of like, oh, if you have above a certain amount of followers on Instagram, it's 100,000?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Yeah, then you're macro. If you're under 100,000, then you're micro. And the whole idea is that micro has more of a trusted audience, but, you know, has a lower reach. So you run more campaigns with them, right?
I don't remember what the threshold is, but the short answer is no. Like the influencer game is pretty much the same everywhere. So.
Okay. Anyone else played with the influencer? I guess Asha did a little bit more like ambassador type stuff. But I don't know if that it might be similar. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think they would be considered sort of micro influencers, but more sort of like, you know, one-on-one or word of mouth. But yeah, I can't say we've done too much with like traditional influencers, or we do a bunch of stuff with like YouTube. That's kind of a primary channel for any kind of influencer marketing. But I haven't necessarily noticed a difference between US or Europe there. Kind of, you know, I mean, I think the internet's just very global as far as like reach. So that YouTube kind of just crosses all channels.
Cool. By YouTube, do you mean sort of like asking your community to like make videos of them using the product and showing different features and creations that they make?
Yeah. So we work with like specific influencers. So people already have, you know, like a few hundred thousand, some of them less followers. So they've like built up like a following, they have channels and they already talk about sort of like design or design adjacent topics. And then we work with them. Sometimes it's, you know, they're just excited about the product and they want to talk about it anyway. But other times it's like paid. And it can be anything from like YouTube mentions, or it can be like full dedicated videos where they're doing like a complete walkthrough of like product. And then I think our only learning from that has been like YouTube mentions just work the best for just cost for registration.
Okay, cool. That makes a lot of sense. And I mean, that's an influencer program. So.
True.
Have you seen more impact from getting a mountain of people who are more micro versus like a couple of famous people, famous-ish?
Mm.
And I know it's tough to hear those things.
Yeah. I mean, I think just macro because of the reach and yeah, like we just look at sort of like their costs and then we also look at their retention and then macro just, you know, above a certain threshold, like works better for us, like over 400,000.
Okay, cool. Let's jump to the next one, Grace. I think some of you touched upon this already, but I guess the importance of localization in whatever country you're launching in, and then adjusting your email lifecycle strategy. I think Matt already told me, was it the Germans or who hated push?
Yeah.
Number one, Germans hate push. I think Boris already said, you cannot launch a job ad in France with the exact same message and creative as the US because people just aren't job hoppers as much, right?
I think the whole question of localization, if you're into B2B products, you're probably just fine with English for most products. B2C, sorry. B2B really depends. I mean, if you look at TikTok, Snap, if it's a really easy to use app, don't worry about it. And as long as your app is in English, people will be fine for a very long time. If you're doing something like we did at Kabam, which is really complicated games, you have to localize, because then people will get lost. If the story and, you know, the language of the product is important, you're not going to make any sales if you don't localize the product. So there's no general answer, I think, to this question of how important it is. It really depends on how easy your product is. If you look at other products like Canva, you would never have to translate it, you know, because it's just inputting images on a screen, design, you know, it's a universal language. You don't need to do much there.
I'll take a caveat to that, because Footerim is a competitor to Canva. And what we see is, you know, there's localization of just the language is one of the components, right? But a lot of the product is really understanding the key inputs. So anything like little things like, okay, when you have to export an image, which you have to do in Canva, you know, what's might come first in Turkey, because that's the first platform that users will share stuff on, versus when you go to Indonesia, then that might be kind of Instagram. And so, you know, localization, it's not site, obviously, but there's different other components. I think you have to think about personalization / localization and really what makes sense for your product.
That's very true. Yeah. Just translation often also doesn't work, because a lot of things just don't translate, like jokes or cultural references don't translate at all.
And has anyone told a very in bad taste joke in an ad where you had no idea that you were doing it in another language, or just a really bad taste message?
There's a really bad company name. You probably all know Vix, the site builder, the online site builder Vix.
Uh-huh.
That is a really bad German word. You don't want to use it.
There's also a famous one, Electrolux, which is like a legendary vacuum cleaner company. When they first came to the U.S., their marketing was the Electrolux. It really sucks. You know, nowadays, that would actually pass as a pretty good ad. But like at the time, I think it was like the 60s, and they didn't get it.
That's hilarious. So I think a lot of the questions thus far have been about like growth strategy, entering a market, KPIs, really business oriented stuff in terms of success and how to do it. But I'm actually very curious about working culture and recruiting culture and just different things that you face. What's fun about all four of you is all four of you worked for hyper growth organizations in the US and hyper growth organizations in Europe. So you can really do the like deep comparison there. And I'd love to learn more about that, because that sounds like a fun topic.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting. I think when it comes to like US versus Europe, it's also like not all European countries are the same. So, you know, your experience like working somewhere like London or Amsterdam, where English is sort of like, you know, widely spoken versus say Munich or Prague or, you know, somewhere where it's not as much, could be very different in the work culture. So in Amsterdam, like landing here, where there was a little bit of a tech scene, I mean, I was still young. And then, you know, having everyone speak English just so well, it's crazy sometimes, was just made it very easy to kind of transition in general to work here. And I think one of the biggest things that I noticed is just that, like, you know, after I got used to kind of working here for a while, is just sort of the work-life balance people have. And it's not just like a thing people say. It's like they actually take a month off, you know, in the summer and like just leave town and go to like get in their car and go to like Spain and Italy and France. And it's like in the tech industry, you know, in San Francisco, that would be almost unheard of. And I think just people really know how to prioritize like family and work-life balance. And it's like, you just don't hear as much of that like classic San Francisco, like I'm burnt out story, but people are still, you know, they're still intent on like their work. They're really passionate about it. They're better at like that balance. So I think for me, that was like one of the more positive aspects of like working here in tech.
I think talent means hiring regulations and hiring an admin. I probably talk from the worst country and not doing good advertising in Europe. That's France. The cost of hiring someone and firing someone, it's so insane that you have to really like be sure. So you're, you know, when you decide to hire one, it's a commitment to that country. We went through that kind of exercise at Bumble. I was like, it really takes a lot for us and like a commitment and, you know, a long-term plan. that means that, you know, we're going to hire someone, but then the firing costs are really, really big. And so I think you have to take that in consideration. And each country has their, you know, it's the whole package, right? So the admin of like setting up the office and hiring, et cetera. And then from a cultural standpoint, what is the type of culture that you want to develop?
Yeah, that's super fascinating. Yeah. So people maybe that might lead to longer tenures from candidates as well. I'm sorry, for people hired because of the firing costs.
Oh, I would throw in, and I don't know if you guys agree with this, but what I've discovered, so, you know, I've led teams in China, Australia, basically all around the world. And actually the more that I see, the more I realize that people kind of all want the same thing, right? They, by and large, people want to be given a certain amount of direction, a certain amount of clarity, and like be heard. And that transcends pretty much every culture that I've worked in. It's actually amazing how well basic stuff like, you know, respect and listening translates, with the exception of, there's different interpretations of how people talk. So for instance, like, you know, Germany, it's valued to be direct, but if you're being really direct in some places in Asia, it's considered like rude. Whereas if you're being very indirect, sometimes that is the best way to communicate in a place like Asia, and you'll be seen as sneaky in a place like Germany. But at the core, I found that like people just kind of want to do a good job. And so it's amazing how effective you can be to just listen and then, you know, point towards the goalpost and people want to run that direction.
Listen, point towards the goalpost and people will run towards the direction in Germany?
Everywhere.
Okay.
I think just about everywhere, I think people, you know, once they're in a company, like they want to do a good job. Everybody wants to do a good job.
Mm-hmm.
But unless you hired the wrong person, but that's like a different animal altogether.
Just to chime in for a minute, if you open up an office in another country, be mindful of things like time zones. I mean, like too many times you get an invite for a meeting from someone in California that's after midnight your time because they just forgot. And also just be mindful to include them, because as soon as you open your first office somewhere, you have to bridge, you know, bring the conversation to them. What happens in the cafeteria around the water cooler doesn't translate into another country. Someone has to take charge of letting everybody know about everything that's going on. And I've been on both sides of that. I've been forgotten a lot by US headquarters. And then when I ran or set up international operations, I did the very same thing. And I had some people that worked with me in both companies come up to me and say, Boris, you know, you're doing the same thing that you always complained about when you came to headquarters. You're forgetting, you know, your field offices. It's so easy. And that will definitely set them up for failure faster than anything else. I think if you don't listen to them and don't include them in your communication, and it's probably the hardest thing in the world to do that across Asia, Europe, you know, US, if you run multiple geos, you know, as Matt did, that's hard. It's really taxing on the management as well.
Makes a lot of sense. I love that. I think all of you touched upon a lot of different like communication areas and differences that in working in the US, and particularly the fact that people, I guess, have a little bit more work-life balance in Europe and actually take their vacations, which probably leads to happier employees, I would imagine.
And we all want company cars. That's unheard of by Silicon Valley employees.
Yeah, really?
Seriously, absolutely. You hire a manager? That's one of the first questions you get asked. Have you ever read an English job ad? The English British job ad will usually spell out the car you get.
Really?
Even if you're working,
like, describe the job and it's like, you get a BMW 3 Series, 5 Series, whatever.
I love
that. So everybody just scans the job ad for the car and they're like, bleh.
It's one of the first questions you always get asked if you hire management level people is what kind of car do I get?
What if it's fully remote? Are they still like, all right, can I get a Range Rover?
I don't know how that's going to change. Not only after COVID, maybe that changes.
Like maybe just get like $100 in Lyft credit. I wonder if people would rather have that than a car sitting in their driveway.
Also, when people talk about their jobs in bars, it's one of the, at least in Germany, one of the top topics. It's what kind of company car do you have? It's
funny.
Really touched point.
Ah, Germany. Well done. That's cool. And I think Boris, you touched upon a little bit on how like there's sort of a little bit of a fear of working for American companies in certain European areas. You touched upon that a little bit earlier, and that, you know, you have to work a little bit harder to overcome some of those fears.
Depending on the region, yeah. I was setting up the game company Kabam in Luxembourg, which it's fairly remote. Mostly it was known for banking and tax evasion. But it's not the most fun place to live and be, but I still had to hire a big team there. And we tried to hire locals, and because we were a game company, we wanted to hire young people that would also play our games. And there the parents still had a big influence, and we failed to hire anyone because all the time their parents said, don't work for Americans. You know, they will hire you, then they will fire you after a year. Go for a traditional Luxembourgish company. You're much better off. And it took us a long time to overcome that. We had to build out a Silicon Valley style office with free lunches, and that got a lot of attention in the press and TV. And we eventually been on TV and in the newspaper enough that the parents knew about us and essentially allowed their kids to come and work for us, kids being 25-year-olds. That was really hard. It took a long time to earn that respect and be safe enough for people to come and join us.
Oh man, maybe you should buy the parents' cars, and that's just like a faster route to get the kids in.
But it's probably different if you know, when we set up an office in Berlin, it was very different. There, you know, working for a cool American startup was all the hype, you know, so you didn't want to go work for us.
Okay.
Really depends on where you are in Europe, which is true for any of the questions, really. There's no Europe. We may have an EU and England now, but there's really no Europe for most of the things you're doing. There's not even a Germany or a France, you know. It's so a model. If you do something in Paris and in Bordeaux or Nice, it doesn't always compare. You know, people are very different. Culture is different in different parts of the country.
That's fascinating. That makes sense. I mean, I'd imagine the company car thing isn't true of all of Europe. Maybe it is.
You get a company bike in Amsterdam.
There's no parking. Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks a lot, everyone. Thanks to our panelists, Boris, Maud, Asha, and Matt. I learned a ton here about, you know, working throughout Europe, launching in Europe, and so forth.
Thanks for tuning in to Culture, Talent, and Growth. If you found value in this conversation, please leave a review, subscribe, and share this episode with a friend. You can visit bringruckus.com for more ways to connect. And remember, new episodes come out on Tuesday.